Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you again for joining us here in the darkness on the edge of town. We are going to put together a really neat show for you here. Really neat. Gee, Beav, this is going to be a swell show.
It's swell, Wally.
We've got a great show. We've got Lauren Coleman, who's a noted cryptozoologist and author, is going to be with us here for the first hour, and we're going to talk about all the different cryptozoological beasts and mythical creatures out there and find out if we can separate a little fact from fiction. Second hour of the show, we've got our good friends from Penn State, and they're going to be on breaking news tonight on our show about the upcoming UNIFCON 6. You want to be here for the sixth hour, or for the second hour, as we talk about UNIFCON 6. Yes, it's a marathon show this evening, so we're going to be here for 6 hours taking your pledges. So we do want to get into that. I do want to make a couple of mentions. First of all, everybody here at Darkness on the Edge of Town, all two of us, would like to wish a speedy recovery to our good friend, Mr. Grant Wilson, who some of you may or may not know had an appendicitis and was in the hospital over the weekend. So we wish him well, speedy recovery. And I also want to take a few minutes to thank all of our friends on MySpace. We've been putting out a call lately for a lot of healings and prayer requests for people that have been in dire need. Everybody from TAPS member Donna LaCroix, who was in a car accident, was hit by a drunk driver. She's recovering nicely and is amazed because the damage that she sustained, once everybody started pouring out the Reiki and the help, she was able to recover quite quickly and quite nicely. And she just wants me to extend to all of you a huge thanks and debt of gratitude that she owes all of you for pouring out your love and affection. And there's been more since then. And right now, if you get a chance, you can stop by our MySpace page. And there's a link for it right on our main page at darknessradio.com. You just click it, go on over there. And in a blog, we're talking about a child that is very ill, and already we're seeing effects from the prayer and the Reiki that's being sent out by the hundreds of people that have contacted me. So again, I want to thank you very much for that. And if you have special requests, feel free to email them over. We'll do our best to get them posted and see if we can maybe get a little healing and health and love coming your way. I also want to make a quick mention, as we do each week, and will until then. You can see Dave Schrader from Darkness on the Edge of Town radio show at the 2007 South Coast Paranormal Convention, which is July 20th through the 21st. And along with me, you'll be able to see speakers like Chris Fleming, who we all know and love from Dead Famous on the Biography Channel, Psychic Sensitive, and Ghost Stalker Richard Sennett. We've got Capers founder Derek Bartlett and Capers member and Psychic Sensitive Tom Durant. PRI member Guy Jackson will be there. We also know Patrick Burns will be there, and our buddies from Terror Normal. You want to go check out their website. It's at myspace.com/Terror Normal, or just go to terrornormal.com. However, they've got some very interesting footage of what they believe to be Bigfoot roaming the halls of the Queen Mary. Did you see that, Tim?
I saw it. It was pretty scary.
Pretty scary, yeah, stuff. So, yeah. Bastards. They got photographs of me. But I was doing my Bigfoot stroll, so they got photos up there. But go take a look. It's a cute little deal. They're going to be out at the convention as well, so please come on out, join us. If you go check out their website for all the information, you can go to www.woodwardpsychic.com. That's WOODWARD PSYCHIC.com. Now, for another quick update, then we'll get on with our first guest of the evening. We are doing our paranormal retreats, the Queen Mary, which is coming up in December. We are more than half sold out on this event already. People are jumping on it like crazy. So do not hesitate to pick up your tickets. They are going to go fast. And hear me now, believe me later. Once you pay for your ticket and you get your confirmation email, please call and reserve your room. We are only able to obtain in most of these places upwards to about 100 rooms. And they do sell out very fast. So don't be surprised if you hold off to get your room and go to a week beforehand and then cry to me that there's no room available. You got to call and book your room. It's very affordable. We've got rates. Can you believe this, Tim? To sleep on the Queen Mary. Three nights, only $99 a night.
That's it?
That's it. $99 a night to sleep on the Queen Mary. Beautiful ship, beautiful hotel. It's going to be a fantastic time. You can join Jay and Grant. You can join Tim and myself, Chris Fleming, Patrick Burns, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Marie D. Jones will be out there, the author. Lloyd Auerbach and Ankasha are going to be with us. So it's going to be a great time. And the other trip, which is coming up here in August, and tickets are selling very fast for this. This is going to be an amazing event. We are going to Waverly Hills Sanitarium. So many people that have attended our events want to go to Waverly Hills. We've put together what we believe to be one of the premier events at Waverly Hills this year, along with our good friends Charlie and Tina Mattingly from Waverly Hills, the owners. We're going to be in there for not one, but two full nights of investigation. So when you sign on to this group, you get two full nights of investigations, not just one. Two full nights, and you'll be able to hang out with the likes of John Zaffis, Adam Bly, Chris Fleming, Patrick Burns, Dave and Tim, and the boys from Terror Normal are going to be there, Chad and Adrian. A lot of other great guests, so make sure that you check out the website. You can go to darknessevents.com. Sign up for Waverly Hills. Those are going to go fast. Now, though, we're going to get into the segment, the beginning of our show, and we've got a great one, as I mentioned. We've got some great guests coming up, so please stick with us as we go through this evening. Our first guest is Lauren Coleman, and he's a best-selling author and noted cryptozoologist, as I mentioned. He has a new book out called Mysterious America, which is kind of a fun, readable guidebook to America's most popular local legends. And he'll prepare the readers for their own adventure. You get to hear about phantom panthers haunting eastern North America, the Bay State ghosts and spirits, mad gassers in Illinois. See, they know about my dad.
I know.
Can you believe that? He is a mad gasser in Illinois. Champ, the famous Lake Champlain monster, the Minnesota Iceman, which I want to know about because I'm sitting across from him, and I've watched him for years, and I didn't know that you actually go out in the cold weather as well, Tim.
Yeah, I do.
Excellent.
Little known fact.
Yes, Lauren, thank you for joining us here in the darkness on the edge of town. Appreciate you coming in and spending the evening with us.
Sure. It's good to be here.
We wanted to talk to you for quite a while, and I'm glad that we're able to settle down and get you on the show. I mean, you're one of the most noted authorities on cryptozoology out there, and you cover all these different topics. I know that you have a fascination with this field. For our listeners and people who have not had a chance to read your books, can you just give us a quick synopsis? What got Lauren Coleman into the world of cryptozoology? Did you have experiences of your own, or were you just like Tim and I just love to read about the mysteries when we were children?
Well, it actually occurred because I was reading the books of Charles Fort. And Charles Fort, of course, was an American intellectual writer in the 1920s and 30s. I was reading those books in 58 and 59. And then in 1960, March of 1960, actually, I saw a Japanese movie by a recent documentary filmmaker, Ishiro Honda. And the film was half-human, and it was about the abominable snowman being captured, having interactions with Westerners, and they weren't great interactions, and he actually, this abominable snowman was captured, and the baby was, the older adult was killed, and the baby was captured. Anyway, I went to school the next day, and I asked my teachers, what's this about the abominable snowman? And so the teacher said, don't study that, don't read anything about it. So, of course, for me, that just stimulated
right.
my curiosity. And I read and devoured everything I could. Within a year, I was out there in the field with game wardens investigating Black Panther reports. And
wow.
One thing led to another, and I started corresponding. Within 2 years, I had 400 correspondents around the world. Remember when we used to write letters? I was getting quite a few of those a week. So Wow. So it wasn't as easy to, as email is now when I have about 500 emails a day. But
well, now I'm a little interested, Lauren. Tell me about this. Now this was a documentary or was it just a film?
Honda was actually the person that went on to do Godzilla and Rodan and all of those. But one of his earliest, he was a documentary filmmaker. And so one of the first films he made in the science fiction genre was Half Human, which really had a much more documentary feel to it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't very exaggerated. It was actually, he had filmed it among the Ainu in Japan, and the film is actually banned in large sections of Japan because the Ainu are like our Native Americans, and there's been a lot of PC political wranglings over there about not showing the film. So I felt very lucky to be able to see it in 1960. It was made in 1958.
Wow. All right. That's amazing. So it was basically just kind of the same thing like for Tim and I, just something that sparked your interest in these creatures. I mean, I remember growing up and all the photographs of, the famous video footage or film footage of Bigfoot and the famous portrait of Nessie's head coming up out of the murky water, and all you see is the black shadow of his head coming out of the water. That did it in for me. I would pick up every book I could and devour them just to learn more about these characters and creatures. I've mentioned on the show in the past, I think I was about 10 or 11 years old and out fishing at my grandparents' pond in Alabama. They had 40 acres and they only used about 1 or 2 acres of it. And we used to hear things boom, boom, boom walking around in the woods all the time that, what the hell was living back there? We never saw bears. We never saw anything like that. And then the one time my cousin and I were sitting there fishing and we both looked up and we saw what appeared to be a gray, furry paw pull back a branch and then a head lean in, a big furry head. And the two of us were like Scooby-Doo characters, man. We were in the air, our legs pedaling, and we were back at the house in a second. But that really kind of helped ignite my fire as well. I mean, is that, from all the stories that you collect, is that pretty normal for what everybody sees out there? And are they gray? Do you see many gray Bigfoot or Sasquatch or Yeti, whatever you want to call them?
Well, there's a real difference between the Bigfoot, the classic traditional Western Bigfoot, which tend to be darker colors, red, and it sounds like from what you're describing, in the South, in Alabama, there's a whole different coloration that you find there. In the East, we often actually find Bigfoot-like creatures that are said to have white spots on their, white areas on their arm, or there's one from Michigan that's actually called Old Yellow Top because it has a little bit blonder hair, so the gray to blonde to, lighter colors is definitely there in the eastern United States. And, of course, what you described, I mean, it could have been any number of things, but, because it was actually using what seemed like a hand and looking at you, it has all of the curiosity factors that you find in another primate. And from the South, of course, the skunk ape, the booger, the swamp ape, a lot of those kinds of stories really talk about them being near water, being very curious, and also having these colors that aren't very dark.
Yourself, have you seen what you believe to be a Bigfoot?
No, I'm not one of the, I'm driven by the passion, of course, to investigate cryptozoology and look into these creatures. I may have seen a Black Panther in southern Illinois crossing the road when I was carpooling with some individuals on the way from work, but late at night. It was like 11:30 at night after this is obviously one of the factors that you always look in eyewitness reports are the context, and this was after a long, hard day working at a mental hospital, so we were all very tired, but we saw this thing cross the road. But no, I've never seen a Bigfoot. I've never seen a Loch Ness Monster. I've never seen a lot of things, but that hasn't kept me from investigating and actually interviewing thousands of people now all over the United States, North America, Loch Ness, Virgin Islands, wherever I can, Mexico, all of these places I've been able to go.
How many of the stories that you collect do you just sit back and kind of internally roll your eyes and think these people are just smoking something funny to see what they're seeing? And how many do you think are legitimate views of some kind of creature?
Well, I never roll my eyes, even internally. I never think about people drinking or alcohol. I think that's, you know, really, as investigators, that's somewhat dismissive and demeaning of people. People have real experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I would come in here and say that what you saw near the lake was nothing more than a bear trying to look for berries, that makes you feel horrible, and I have absolutely no solid evidence that you didn't see a Bigfoot. What I do know, however, is that from, you know, first believing where people are, what they feel they've seen is an important place to start. But in terms of my investigations, I have a real rule of thumb. About 80% of all of those cryptozoological cases that I really do investigate deeply, I find that that only 20% are the leftovers, the unknowns, those things that are unexplainable. Most of these cases tend to go down to, you know, somebody saw a domestic animal, a mistaken identity, they were too sleepy driving, or you know, there was really mundane explanations for what they were seeing, or and the actual hoaxing or the actual you know, intoxications are maybe 0.5% of all the cases and are really not a major factor. What you really have to look out for is, of course, that most people who see things in the dark or in semi-dark tend to exaggerate,
right,
tend to be frightened, and tend to not be good witnesses, ultimately.
Okay. You know, I'm curious about, are you familiar with Todd Standing?
Yes, I am. I'm not too impressed with what I'm hearing about that situation.
Okay. And for our listeners, a couple weeks back we had Todd Standing on April 1st, and Todd claims that
Good day to have him on.
Right, he knows how to track down Bigfoot and has footage of it that he's taken, and right now he's working to protect Bigfoot in Canada and then trying to get the United States to do the same, and then he claims he'll be able to bring people directly to their lairs and give honest-to-God proof of Bigfoot. Why do you... maybe I'm reading it wrong here, but it sounds like you're pretty cynical about his story or abilities. Am I understanding that right?
I'm not cynical. I'm skeptical.
Skeptical,
because,
okay.
On the one hand, it seems like this whole business about the petition, which didn't get him enough publicity, now he's come out with Bigfoot is soon to be extinct. These just seem to be kind of run-of-the-mill publicity stunts. There are people out there that have been interviewed, and they've pointed to the fact that he actually put some ads in different trade magazines looking for actors to play Bigfoot before he actually filmed his quote-unquote real film. I've heard from other people who have analyzed the film and in some depth and think that it's nothing more than a hoax that he's perpetrating for money. I would need to have some of this evidence put before me, but right now all I'm seeing is just another exploitation of Bigfoot to make somebody some money, to keep coming up with publicity stunts.
Well, no, on our show, he said it wasn't about the money. He really was worried about protecting these because he was able to track them before, and he led people he believed there to them, and they exploited the area. His goal is to take some diehard skeptics and cryptozoologists there to prove to them this case. Would you be interested in being a part of an exploration like that?
Sure. I mean, obviously, I go any place where I am able to, and I need to be very cautious when people like this come along, and where there seems to be evidence that you put ads in trade magazines to get people to play Bigfoot.
And now that's interesting. I'd never heard that before, so I appreciate you. And that's something we'll look into for a future episode here.
Sure.
Try to learn a little bit more about. So let's talk about some of the characters that you've written about in your new book, and see if you could tell us a little bit more about the one thing that I was interested in is, what is the Iceman of Minnesota? We live here in Minnesota, Tim and I haven't heard of this legend, so I'd love to know a little bit more about it.
Well, this is what Ivan T. Sanderson and Bernard Heuvelmans, I don't know if you, it may have been called, it's usually called the Minnesota Iceman or, you know, a variety of other names. What occurred was in 1967, an anthropology student was at a stock show and one of the exhibits there was a man-like creature, hair-covered, sort of looking like a Homo erectus or a Neanderthal, was under ice in a cabinet in an exhibition, and he tried to get all of his professors from the university to come look at it, and they wouldn't do it, so he rang up cryptozoologist Ivan T. Sanderson in New Jersey, and Ivan Sanderson at the time was being visited by Bernard Heuvelmans from France, and they decided to journey out to Rolling Meadow, Minnesota, where Frank Hansen was keeping the exhibit in a storage shed, you know, under refrigeration. And they were able to take pictures, examined it for 3 days. Accidentally, one of their heat lamps cracked the ice on the exhibit, and this odor of putrefied flesh came out. So they felt that there was something there as far as it being a real exhibit of a real body. And that, Ivan Sanderson went on the Johnny Carson show late in December of 1969 and talked about it. And then the pictures were very quickly, Bernard Heuvelmans had promised he wasn't going to publish on it, but as soon as he got back to France, he wrote a scientific paper on it, got it published, named it, a scientific Latin name, and then Ivan Sanderson decided he was going to publish very quickly and published in an Italian journal as well as in Argosy magazine. So, and that exhibit was taken to Canada, and actually when it got to the border, the FBI, Customs, and the Smithsonian got very involved, and the man that was exhibiting it said, he was the front man for a millionaire who was a very religious person that wanted to float out this exhibit to see if people would believe there was a missing link. And he switched bodies. He switched the real carcass for a Hollywood modeled dummy carcass. And that's probably what you may have heard right. about if you'll read a little bit more about it. And in my book, I talk about all the updates. I talk about the people that were there. Some of who are my friends and associates, and really bring it up to date.
Well, Lauren, we have to take a quick break. We thank sure. everybody for tuning into The Darkness on the Edge of Town. We're talking to best-selling author and noted cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman. We'll be back with more right after this.
Adopting aliens and giving them good homes since 1953. Just don't tell our landlord.
EC phone home.
Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
It's Dave and Tim shacking up in the darkness on the edge of town.
For 58 years, Fate has consistently supplied its loyal readership with a broad array of true reports of the strange and unknown. Fate is a factual magazine containing articles by experts in all walks of life, and by others just like you who have something dynamic, significant, and truthful to say. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, archaeological hotspots, alternative science, and much, much more. To receive your free Fate magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit our website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730 or www.fatemag.com. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Are you tired of reading about what couple in Hollywood is breaking up or divorcing? Have you ever wondered where you can find the news that covers the subjects that you are really interested in? I would like to invite you to visit SupernaturalNews.com. Supernatural News uses the latest internet technology to search for the topics we know you will be interested in reading. News of the latest Bigfoot, UFO, or Loch Ness Monster sightings. Read about the latest conspiracy theories and urban legends. Supernatural News, where belief and reality merge.
Ghosts, goblins, witches, creatures of the night. Yep, that just about covers everybody Dave and Tim have ever dated.
Oh my God, this girl's really turning me on.
Welcome back to the darkness on the edge of town.
Good evening and welcome back to the show. I want to take a quick moment and mention one of our sponsors, Supernatural News. There's a banner form right on our website. You can check out all the new in Supernatural News each week. where they update the website almost daily with new stories that they're pulling off the internet and from all over. So please take a look there. It's a great source for any of you involved in the supernatural and paranormal. You get your Bigfoot, UFO, ghost stories, and more there. Again, go to supernaturalnews.com. Would like to welcome you all back to the show, where our guest is Lauren Coleman, and he's an author, best-selling author, and noted cryptozoologist. He has a brand new book out called Mysterious America. And if you go to our website at Darkness Radio, we'll have the link up there for the next couple of days, and I invite you to take a look at it. He covers many of the different unbelievable creatures that seem to be inhabiting our planet that we're unaware of. And with that question in mind, Lauren, getting back into this, do you feel that with all of the building and, you know, all the encroachment we're doing on, you know, natural wildlife and areas, do you believe that we've pretty much tapped most of the sources for finding creatures like this out? I mean, can they really hide in America still and not be found?
Oh, most definitely. I think that it's really foolish in some level for people, especially biologists, who feel that, you know, all the animals have been discovered. We know, for instance, that there's large portions of the ocean that are still unexplored.
Right.
I'm calling you from Maine tonight. The state of Maine, 95% of the land surface of Maine is covered in trees. This is one of the most wooded states. People can be driving their cars in the northern part of Maine, and they can be within 2 feet of a moose and not even see it. 80% of the Pacific Northwest is covered in trees and wilderness areas. As recently as less than 100 years ago, the woodland bison was found in Canada, 50 miles from a wildlife station that had been there for 50 years. So we know that animals can hide well, that the more intelligent the animal is, such as the primate, such as hopefully, you know, Bigfoot is a primate that seems to be of some intelligence. They probably avoid man, avoid human beings in great numbers, and it's only the incidental situations where humans and Bigfoot overlap where we're really seeing them.
So you do believe that Bigfoot then does exist, that there is some form of primate walking amongst us here in the United States that we just haven't been able to find?
Well, I'll give you the same answer I've given the media for 25 years. I don't believe in any of these creatures. I think belief really is the domain of religion. And as a scientist, as a cryptozoologist, I accept the reality that the evidence is pointing in the direction that Bigfoot appears to be real. But I think that when you have quote-unquote true believers, it really does get in the way of examining the evidence skeptically, critically,
right,
but also being open-minded. I think that we have to really understand there are a lot of people out there that, especially in the age of the Internet and YouTube and MySpace pages, where people all of a sudden want to be your latest Bigfoot filmmaker or your latest Bigfoot eyewitness, and it's got really, in many ways, diluted.
No, I totally agree with you on that. I think there's, and I think we've actually brought ourselves to the technological point of it's hard to believe any footage I see now. You know, I mean, I see some amazing ghost video and Bigfoot video and things. And, you know, it's funny, Penn and Teller, I'm sure you're familiar with this, pulled off a hoax where they videotaped what they, you know, believed to be Bigfoot, and they had set up a friend of theirs to wear this costume and kind of walk around. You're familiar with the story, correct?
Right, the Sierra footage. Yeah.
Right. Now, they did something like this. The funny thing I find, I mean, people accepted it, but so many people didn't because it was too clear of footage. You know, we look at the old footage, and because it's grainy and popping, well, that must be real. But, you know, we've come to the level where things are so clean and crisp that it's hard to believe it's hard to believe it's real. I've got friends of mine that just dink around with their computer at home, and they're able to make really impressive, creepy-looking ghost video that, you know, you could confuse quite a few people with that kind of footage doing something like that. So I don't know.
Right.
It's going to be hard unless we can start bringing up bodies and proving these things. I don't know how, even with video footage, and if you had Geraldo Rivera out in the field get clubbed by him on camera, you know, people would still think it was Gary Busey out there having a sabbatical on the weekend and clubbing Geraldo or something. I mean, you know, it would be just nobody would believe it. do you think it's going to take a body to show up to inspire people to actually believe this?
I do. I think that what we are really having to consider now is that most of the footage is really like an extension of an eyewitness report. Mm-hmm. And so what we forensically have to do is investigate the person. You know, what's the credibility of the individual? What's the credibility of what they're trying to do with the film? And really do a psychological autopsy of that individual. And in many ways, the one man that you've brought up today, you know, his footage and his background as a filmmaker and, you know, his grammar, and maybe he's trying to pull a hoax on all of us and trying to do some kind of psychological, you know, PhD paper on all of Bigfooters to see how far they'll go along with his hoax, are all the things that people are writing about because the footage doesn't look so good, and there's been many questions about him. So obviously, the ultimate situation will be that we need a body. And, you know, I'm not for hunting these things, and I've always been on the no-kill camp, but we definitely need to capture, take DNA samples, observe them, photograph them, show them to some of the leading scientists in the world, and then release them in a reserve, probably. But I also have said that my prediction is that within the next 25 years, we're going to get a real body because a lumber truck is going to hit one.
Oh, really? You think it's going to be something that simple that's going to bring us a body?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a chance discovery. It's going to be an accident. We do not have a situation that we did during Victorian times. We don't have good funding. There were museums and zoos that were hunting for the mountain gorilla and the giant panda for 60 years before they found a live one or a dead one. And here we have in the United States and Canada merely weekend warriors that are underfunded, that are doing this on their own, that you know, half of them are doing it for social reasons. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But the coordinated effort to be in the field for 3 months or 6 months is just not there because there's no funding.
That has amazed me, and we've talked about that on other shows, too, is why we can't get government funding to go out and actually really put some effort into this. Or do you believe that it is being done by the government, but they're keeping it secret? I mean, do you buy into any of the conspiracy theory of that source that, you know,
no,
the government just doesn't want us to know?
No, I think our government's pretty dumb about all of this. I think that they find it, you know, foolish and laugh at people that are hunting for Bigfoot. I think that there's probably satellite footage of Bigfoot, and they're just erasing it and going over it, waiting for the terrorists to come across from Quebec to Canada to Maine. And I think that there's probably, it's not a conspiracy, it's just a conspiracy of stupidity, if anything.
Wow, that's an impressive thought. I agree. I think that they, you're right, they'd probably be more interested in Al-Qaeda crossing the borders than Sasquatch, yeah?
Oh, yeah, I think that's where their direction of all the attention has been for the last 10 years, and they're not at all looking for different bodies or, you know, animals that may be showing up on heat-seeking different...
thermal gams, right.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you about a couple more of these creatures that are out there. I'd like a little bit more insight on it. And I'll do the scarier one for last, but I'm a little interested in this. Alligators in sewers. Is there any real proof to back any of this ever having occurred?
Well, the reason I wrote the chapter in the book and started looking into this is that if you look in most of the folklore books, they really pinpoint the alligators in the sewers to the 1960 tales of white alligators living with the marijuana seeds down in the sewers. You know, that people were flushing their marijuana seeds down and they're alligators, but I was able to track it back journalistically that there were reports, many reports of alligators in the sewers in the 1930s. And actually, the superintendent of sewers in the 1930s, a man named Superintendent May, it was really a book that was overlooked for many years, but he confirmed that his workers, his sewer workers, were coming back and reporting alligators. And he, you know, checked to see if they were drinking whiskey and all of those things, and then he said, found that they weren't. There were actually alligators down there, and he he sent them down with rifles, and they flushed out the main sections of the sewer and forced the alligators into the side tunnels and then went there and shot them and killed them. But you still hear reports of alligators in specific sewers around New York City and other cities.
So that is a an urban legend that at one point was true.
Yes,
but it's definitely. Probably just keeps going from there of, oh, well, this happened. My cousin was working for the sewer system, and they know about it only because they've heard the story, and they're kind of perpetuating it.
Right. It's definitely an urban legend now, and, you know, the people in New York City laugh it off every year because they get, you know, letters during the summer about, can I come see your alligators in the sewer?
Well, yeah, I heard it because when I had originally heard it was the 50s were pretty popular for exotic pets, and a lot of the kids would get alligators, and they would keep them
right.
in the tanks on the back of their toilets.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I think they did an episode of Leave It to Beaver like that. If you, I don't know if you recall that. Yeah, he had the alligator in the tank, but then they used to flush them when it'd get too big to try to deal with, and that's why
right.
they believe these creatures were roaming the states underneath the city, eating
right.
and living off of our pets and things like that.
And most of those were caimans, so it was pretty easy to tell if you found, you know, in Indiana along the Wabash River, if that was a caiman and not an alligator, that we could quickly tell those were probably pets first.
Right. How about, talking about this is something that has always bothered me, the giant snakes. I remember the footage that they showed a few years back, well, probably about 15 years ago now, where the lady kept hearing her little toy poodle or whatever it was squealing out in the yard. And they went out there and looked, and they showed, or she saw what appeared to be a giant snake going back under their house. And they've actually shown the footage of them pulling the snake out from underneath her house, and it was like some astronomical 20-foot snake.
Yeah, probably a Burmese python. Was that in Arkansas?
I don't remember what city it was, but it was some, like, you know, suburb. And they said, geez, you know, how many little kids play out in this area and in the little wooded area right in the back? And they said that that's where they thought it probably stalked most of its prey at night, was going out into the little wooded area back there, and that's where kids hung out. So,
well, we definitely have a problem with the exotic pet trade. You know, people get these animals, they grow huge, they, you know, go from mice to rats to rabbits, and then they're eating your neighborhood dog. So they release them and think they're doing somebody a favor, but that's, you know, that does happen. It's really a major problem now in Florida. But what I'm interested in, what I really recorded in the book, was how during the CCC times, the 1930s, there were huge snakes being reported in different parts of the United States, ones that were 40 feet tall, and the old-time description often was as large around as a stovepipe. You know, and they were black stovepipes and black snakes. And so there does seem to have been some sort of historical records of those, Cleveland, Ohio, Indiana. A lot of Midwestern states tended to have those, just kind of like the giant turtle that is seen in a certain lake in Indiana still today.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Let me ask you real quickly before we take our next break. I know you said that you don't believe in any one of the, you know, creatures that are out there, but what is your thought on Loch Ness? Do you believe that it is just too far away, too far away from any major land or water source to be any kind of creature like a dinosaur that may be living there? Do you believe that it's maybe more along the lines of the giant eels that they're finding now, body remains on the shore?
Loch Ness is a very interesting lake. It's actually only 6 miles from the ocean, and about 30 of the reports talk about these animals on land and walking across land. So I think we have to really take into consideration that this is probably a walrus, seal-like creature that's undiscovered and communicating between the ocean and Loch Ness. Loch Ness is so large, there's enough water in Loch Ness to cover every person on Earth under 6 feet of water. And
wow.
It's just an enormous reservoir.
Well, I thought what to me was very interesting and very telling was, you know, we were talking a little bit ago about technology getting too good. Actually,
right.
I think technology has helped us to disprove more of Nessie's claims, you know, the humps and rolls in the water, they've now shown on a bunch of the documentaries that as they close in on it with clear and DVR film and things like that, that's so clear, you actually see it's not humps or anything coming out of the water, it's the roll of the wave. And it's an optical illusion from the distance that you're at to see what appears to be humps in the water. So I think technology might be helping us more on something like that.
Right, but the other side of it is with Loch Ness, because of the side strobe sonar and sonic evidence, we're getting good pictures, you know, from the 1970s onward from Robert Ryan's expedition of this creature that shows a flipper that has a long neck. And those underwater photographs from Loch Ness has caused some of the best evidence and the most doubt among scientists that there still might be something down there that they don't know about.
Right. Before we go to break, I have a question from Shay on our chat boards. She wants to know, Lauren, have you ever seen the photograph of the giant snake that was taken from the air in Africa?
Yes, I have. That was supposedly a pilot swooping down and taking a picture of it. It seems rather compelling. It's just it'll be like everything else, though. People will dispute it because there's no real reference points for how large it was. It looks quite large, but we really can't tell.
I haven't actually seen it. How big are they assuming that it would be if it truly was what they were thinking it is?
Gigantic, 50, 60 feet long.
Wow.
It seemed to be reaching up to the plane from the water. So
wow.
It's quite a photograph.
Yet another reason I'll never go to Africa. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Darkness on the Edge of Town with our guest, Lauren Coleman. And if you'd like more information on his book, Mysterious America, you can go to our website at darknessradio.com, click on the show tab, and then you'll see the photograph of his book, Mysterious America. You can click it. It'll take you right to Amazon where you can order a copy yourself. Or look for him in any bookstore at Lauren, L-O-R-E-N, last name Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N. We'll be back with more right after this.
I am Greenblock 6. And when I am in your galaxy, I listen to Dave and Tim on the Darkness on the Edge of Town.
For 58 years, Fate has consistently supplied its loyal readership with a broad array of true reports of the strange and unknown. Fate is a factual magazine containing articles by experts in all walks of life, and by others just like you who have something dynamic, significant, and truthful to say. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, archaeological hotspots, alternative science, and much, much more. To receive your free Fate magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit our website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730 or www.fatemag.com. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
George Clooney, Carmen Diaz, Oprah, Ellen, George Bush, Diane Pelosi.
What are you doing?
I'm making a list of people I want to tell about charity checks.
Do you know any of those people?
No, but if I can get to them, they might want to tell the public how cool it is to use giving certificates as presents instead of gift certificates.
Giving certificates?
Yeah, you know. They can be used as a donation to any legitimate charity. So the person who gives a charity check gets the tax deduction, and the person who gets one decides where the money goes.
Why don't you just tell people directly about charity checks yourself?
Like anyone would listen to me.
www.charitychecks.us for information about the perfect present.
Well, no, they're not going to listen to you like that. But if you just said that Charity Checks provides a unique way to turn your gift money into giving money, they might pay attention.
Catchy.
Then you just casually say the web address, charitychecks.us, America's Giving Certificate.
I still think a celebrity endorsement would be more effective.
If you read Taps Para Mag every month, you'll be able to tell the difference between the absurd.
Could not go to work because Bigfoot stole my car.
And the creepy. Taps Para Mag takes you where few would ever go on purpose. From exclusive interviews with the cast of The Ghost Hunters to the latest trends in technology in the field of the paranormal. To join our journey, order at tapsparamag.com.
Are you tired of reading about what couple in Hollywood is breaking up or divorcing? Have you ever wondered where you can find the news that covers the subjects that you are really interested in? I would like to invite you to visit SupernaturalNews.com. Supernatural News uses the latest internet technology to search for the topics we know you will be interested in reading. News of the latest Bigfoot, UFO, or Loch Ness Monster sightings. Read about the latest conspiracy theories and urban legends. Supernatural News, where belief and reality merge.
The smell of voodoo hangs in the air. Either that or Dave and Tim had the seven bean salad for dinner.
Don't nobody go in the bathroom for about 35, 45 minutes. Somebody open the window.
Welcome back to the darkness, or whatever is hanging in the air, on the edge of town.
Good evening and welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Lauren Coleman is our guest, and he's a best-selling author with a new book called Mysterious America. And I hope that you will take a look and pick up a copy of the book. And, of course, now, Lauren, do you actually have a website as well? I don't have that pulled up in front of me.
I blog every day on CryptoMundo.com, and that's probably the best place where people find information about what I'm doing and my books. And I was just over at Lake Champlain a couple weeks ago with a Japanese mini expedition, so I talk about things like that there.
All right, with doing the investigations that you go to now, are these funded by groups that want you to come out and investigate, or do you just do this because it's the love of the game?
Well, you know, my passion certainly. I don't go on vacation unless it's connected with something to do with cryptozoology. So when, for instance, in 1999, when I took my two sons over to Loch Ness for a two-week vacation, I also combined it with giving the keynote talk at a cryptozoology symposium and doing a surface expedition for 10 days. So I don't take vacations unless they're combined with that. But what we were talking about funding not coming from museums or zoos any longer. What I'm finding is that because so many people want to make documentary films, they might not necessarily pay you to do that work, but they'll at least fly you there and ask for an interview and different things like that. So, you know, I've gone to the Black Forest of Pennsylvania looking for thunderbirds thanks to a kids documentary film company in Canada, where I was just over at Lake Champlain looking for Champ, and that was funded by, you know, airfare and stuff from the Japanese Nippon TV. So that seems to be how people are getting around these days, because none of us cryptozoologists are very rich.
Okay. Come on. We know the babes and the money are rolling off you, Lauren. You can't fool us.
I wish.
Let me ask you this. With doing the investigations, and you said you haven't actually seen anything, but have you seen compelling evidence for yourself of footage, like, or not footage, but when you've gone to a site, have you seen what could be a giant flipper mark in the mud, or have you seen the Bigfoot print with the dermal ridges right in the mud? Have you seen anything like that that would lead you to believe, wow, this is pretty compelling?
Well, I'm doing this for 47 years. I've seen everything. I've seen, you know, people have told me that they just hit a black panther, and I go there and find a little kitty, so a kitten. All the way to people showing me footprints in the mud, in Illinois, for instance, of panthers, or I've been shown hair samples and stuff. So I think what you have to look at, as you're mentioning, really, is the whole body. For instance, for Bigfoot, you look at 350 years of Native legends, you look at the Patterson film, you look at the hair samples and the analysis that comes back, not human, but near human. You look at fecal material. I've seen it all, and yet we come back once again to what is the most compelling evidence we usually have for most of this stuff is eyewitness accounts. And because I have a psychiatric background as well as anthropology and zoology, I've really combined all of those skills to really investigate these cases very deeply, beyond the things that we can see in front of us, and try to, in some ways, psychiatrically analyze whether or not somebody's trying to pull my leg, whether they may be hallucinating, or have they actually experienced something and show me tangible evidence. Obviously, tangible evidence is what we want first and foremost, but we have to really deal with the fact that 90% of what we're getting is eyewitness accounts.
You know, James Lee in our chat room mentions, and I'm sure you get this question all the times too, where are the skeletal remains of Bigfoot or Chupacabra or you know, Champy or any of these creatures? Why aren't we finding any kind of biological remains anywhere?
Well, the way I answer that is I throw it right back at people, and I've talked to wildlife and biologists all across the country. How often do they find a dead bear in the woods? How often do they find a mountain lion in the woods? When something dies in the woodland forest of North America, they're eaten very quickly. No piece of bone goes unused. You know, porcupines, rodents eat these very quickly. And if we're talking about a population that may be 4,000 individual Bigfoot, which you may have one Bigfoot for every 10,000 bear in the United States, you're not going to find an intelligent primate that's going to leave its body in the middle of a road or in some place where a human can find it. So I think that's one factor. The other factor really is that we have to have some patience. It did take, as I mentioned earlier, 60 years to actually take the first mountain gorilla. It took 60, 70 years to come across and capture the first giant panda. We're really still in the infant stages of looking for Bigfoot. But, of course, Americans are very, give it to me now.
Right.
I want it now. The MTV generation wants everything immediately. And yet we're still, since 1958, if we look at that as the beginning of the modern era of Bigfoot, we're still really in the sort of the mid-range of being able to find these things.
Well, let's wrap up with a couple more of the cool items that you cover in your book. I got to ask this because we joked about it at the beginning of the show. What are the mad gassers in Illinois?
Well, the mad gassers, I think these are kind of the early phase of the Men in Black. We had a report, it was very detailed, in 1944 in Mattoon, Illinois, of a large, darkly, it's something like a creature or entity or a man that had oilskin-type clothing on, with a kind of domed head with a black hat on that. This creature or this thing would go to the windows of houses and spray in a sickeningly sweet gas, and people would be knocked out, and then they would of course come to, and the thing wasn't there anymore. Well, it may be an early X-File, because what I found out was that two FBI agents came to Mattoon to investigate the case. They never could find the person. They never could really track down what it was. And after less than a month, really, the creature, the thing, disappeared. During the time I was investigating it in Illinois in the early 60s, I was able to interview, actually, an eyewitness who was still alive who had actually chased the thing down an alley in Mattoon. A very convincing man, very credible in the community. And over again, we get these kinds of reports about the mad gasser of Mattoon. So the gassing was something that would go into a window. It wasn't something from his body like your father.
Okay. I don't know. My mom's going to be compelled to tell you he is the mad gasser.
Okay.
Let's wrap up with, I think, what is probably one of the scariest topics on your list here. Tell us about phantom clowns.
Yes, phantom.
That's right.
Phantom clowns were one of the most favorite articles that I first wrote about, and so I needed to put that in this book and actually expand it. In 1981, this was before the Internet, of course,
There was a time before the Internet?
No. I was writing articles for Fate magazine and Forty and Times, and all of a sudden, from across the United States, I started getting letters and clippings on kids, usually kids, seeing a van, seeing a phantom clown that would be very scary. They were so scary, in fact, that in the Kansas City area, they were calling them killer clowns. They look like clowns, you know, in the full suit. Some of them talked about them being in white vans with a, you know, a ladder on the back. Very specific descriptions of what they were seeing, and yet they were all kind of popping up across the country, unknown to other cities. This was something that no national story ever came out about it, and only through the sort of 40 and underground, the underground of other investigators that I had going on, was I able to link up that in May of 1981, there were probably about 12 cities across the United States that were having active phantom clown outbreaks. Nobody ever got caught. Nobody ever got hurt. Nobody ever got kidnapped. And yet these phantom clowns were seen in a rising number, and then all of a sudden they disappeared.
Now, when they'd smile, did they have the menacing pointy teeth, or did they just look like men, you know, child molesting men that were dressed up like clowns trying to get children to come to them?
Well, it was kind of the harlequin type of clown with a checkered top.
Oh, sure.
Had that very specific thing, as opposed to the John Wayne Gacy smiling man molester kind of thing. They seemed very menacing. They oftentimes were seen with another clown-like entity in the front seat of one of these vans. Only in one case, one of the Kansas City people said that they thought that the creature, the clown, had a large knife with them. But most of them were just sightings. People were at bus stops or on their way to school. They would see these, and they would get a feeling of foreboding or, danger, and they would quickly go tell an adult or a police officer or something like that.
Creepy. See, now that's something I know we're going to set everybody on edge with for the rest of the night. I can't tell you how many people are terrified by clowns, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think Stephen King helped out anything with his book It, huh?
No, which came after those stories.
Right. I'm sure that probably helped to inspire him as well.
Yeah.
But, Lauren, I appreciate you coming on here. Time was really fast with us. Hopefully we can have you back in the future. And
okay,
as you write more books, we'd love to have you back.
Okay, and good luck with your program.
Thank you very much, Lauren. And thank you all for tuning into the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Stay with us. We're going to be back for Hour 2, where we're going to talk to Ryan, Sergey, and Topher from Penn State's UNIVCon, one of the biggest and most exciting paranormal conferences in the United States. They're going to break some news with us here tonight on the show. We're going to also talk to them about their new TV show, Paranormal State, coming up on A&E Network. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more right after this.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Visit washablesofas.com and discover Anabay, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices, with sofas starting at $699. Anabay brings you the ultimate in furniture innovation with a modular design that allows you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabay is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slides right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get up to 60% off plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.